From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, hell froze over, or something once thought just as unlikely.
Longtime enemies in Northern Ireland joined forces today to form a new unity government. Protestants, led by Reverend Ian Paisley, will run the government jointly with Catholics, led by Martin McGuinness, a veteran commander in the Irish Republican Army.
The end of a war without end. The event itself didn't even make the three big newscasts Tuesday. It was, after all, a rather bland ceremony involving white-haired men smiling gamely at each other. But it concluded a nearly 40-year battle for the six counties of Northern Ireland and the hearts and minds of the world. With over 30 million Irish Americans, that battle has been fought particularly hard here in the U.S. For much of the 90s, movies alone could have kept Northern Ireland in the public's eye. In the Name of the Father, Some Mother's Son, The Crying Game, The Boxer, The Devil's Own, The Jackal, Blown Away, and Patriot Games all used the conflict as a backdrop. Neil O'Dowd, founder of the New York-based Irish Voice newspaper, helped broker U.S. recognition of Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army in the early 90s. He says the films just echoed a growing public awareness as the once shadowy sectarian groups moved the struggle from the theater of war to that of politics.
It was very much a public relations war right from the beginning. Clearly, the IRA had a very distinct point of view that Ireland was unfairly partitioned in 1921. That 600,000 Catholics were corralled into a state that they wanted no part of. The British, on the other hand, held a very strong view that the partition of Ireland was the only way of stopping an all-out conflict, because the 1 million Protestants in the north were never going to accept the United Ireland that the rest of Ireland wanted. So you had these two very distinct and polarizing points of view.
Your newspaper was created to appeal to the sizable Irish-American audience that's interested in Ireland. How did their sympathies wax and wane?
Very much in terms of how bad the violence was. In the 1970s, that was the key period of the Troubles, in the sense that the level of violence was very, very high. And in the 1980s, there began the successful politicization, really, of the Republican struggle. And that began with the hunger strikes in 1981, when 10 Irishmen starved to death in British prisons in Northern Ireland. And if you remember, the key point in all that was when the hunger striker Bobby Sands was actually elected to the British Parliament on his deathbed, which was a very dramatic moment, one that was not just about violence. And I think that Irish America came back and took another look at the IRA and Sinn Féin at that point.
So after the hunger strikes in the early 90s, the Clinton White House began to engage the stalemate in Northern Ireland, and Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin leader, was allowed a visa to come to the United States. This was a man whose voice couldn't even be broadcast in Britain. Now, how did you help engineer that?
Well, I think the main thing was to change the image of the war in Northern Ireland, that this was a hopeless situation. And it was a time when the world was looking beyond the fact that there was new hope in South Africa, that there was new hope in the Middle East. And I think what we did was bring that home to key people in the Clinton White House. No American president had ever indicated any break between his position and that of the British government on Northern Ireland, because the overall relationship was considered far more important. I think the White House began to see it as something that could be a big victory for them.
Who was your contact there?
Initially, my contact was through Senator Edward Kennedy, because you understand right away that if you don't get Senator Kennedy on side in an Irish-American perspective, you really have no hope sending anything to a White House.
And as Tony Blair prepares to leave the scene, there's been a lot of reporting this week on his legacy, and there are a number of politicians who would be happy to deny him credit for the current power-sharing government. How much do you think he really changed the narrative about Northern Ireland, and how much credit do you think he can claim for what happened this week?
I think he can claim enormous credit. There were three pieces to this whole thing. One was the British government, the other was the Clinton administration, and the third was the people in Northern Ireland, like Gerry Adams and ultimately Ian Paisley. But without a British Prime Minister actively involving himself in the search for peace, it would have been utterly impossible. Tony Blair, for 10 years, worked this issue. You know, it would have been so much easier for him to walk away, as so many other British prime ministers had, throwing up their hands, and the media would have said, well done, you know, because it's impossible to solve it anyway. He just stuck at it for relatively little political gain.
Well, let me ask you this. When we think about the end of apartheid in South Africa, what we think of is an incredible international public relations campaign that finally changed the politics. And I wonder, in the case of Northern Ireland, do you think the PR followed the politics or the politics followed the changing PR?
I think the PR followed the politics. I think when you take an armed revolutionary movement, whether it's the ANC or the IRA, and you put them on a path to politics, the people who are able to affect that change are extraordinary people. Because in Irish history, anyone who ever tried to do what Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness just did have been killed. The first principle was they had to sell it to their own people. They had to take the IRA and they had to sell them on the basic idea that violence was not going to work. And this is something we've seen in all these conflicts over the years. Unless the leaders are strong enough to bring their own people along with them first, no amount of PR, no amount of international cooperation will help, because what will happen is the movement will splinter. When you sit in Northern Ireland now and you look at the headlines, as I did the week before the resolution of this issue, and the headlines were about water charges, and the headlines were about politicians threatening each other about water charges, and you think, my God, we have a functioning, boring democracy here. It's wonderful.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil O'Dowd is the founder of the New York newspaper, The Irish Voice.
Another part of Tony Blair's legacy, the 2001 war against the Taliban in Afghanistan. After more than 5 years, freedom has yet to take root, except perhaps in Afghanistan's thriving independent media. Now, however, legislation is making its way through the nation's parliament that could turn the clock all the way back. An ominous portent, last month's police raid on Afghanistan's most popular TV network, Tolo TV, after it made the mistake of offending the Attorney General. But Tolo TV did not back down. Instead, it broadcast footage of what appeared to be an illegal raid. No faces are visible, but we hear what seems to be a Tolo TV staff member asking if they are being forced to obey the police. If the police officer said yes, he would be more or less admitting to illegal entry under current law. But if the new media laws are passed, there likely will be many more incidents like it, and much less recourse for the media outlets. Tolo TV founder Saad Mossani, on the line from Kabul, says it would be difficult to know how to abide by the new legislation.
It could be interpreted in so many different ways that it just puts, you know, fear into anyone who operates the media.
There are a number of eye-opening provisions in the legislation, including one that mandates that the media follow the precepts of Islam, which is a pretty broad provision, and another that prohibits media from insulting individuals or corporations.
Well, that's right. I mean, you could say minister has not done a good job. I mean, that could be interpreted as insulting the minister. You could say that the minister arrived late for his meeting. That could be insulting the minister. This is the scary thing, is that all these articles or provisions in the media laws are subject to so many interpretations that there is little doubt in our mind that they will be used at some stage by a minister or a prosecution that wants to take on the media.
Now, you have some very real experience with that, because your question embarrassed the Attorney General, and he didn't just invoke the media law, he barged into your headquarters. Tell me about that incident.
The Attorney General was summoned before a commission in Parliament, and a number of interesting questions were asked of him. One of the questions related to people being prosecuted and then taken to court, found guilty. The question was, what happens to these people? And I think the Attorney General was referring to their death sentences and saying that they will be executed soon. Now, of course, we played the clip. I mean, we didn't actually quote him. He was very upset. That he was claiming he'd never said that, but of course we had footage of him and we played it. And in this instance, we were in the right, so we refused to pull the story, and he threatened our journalist. Our journalist is a young man, he's only 26 or 27, rushed back to the office. And within minutes, we had the local district police, the local police, who had received verbal instructions from the Attorney General to arrest the reporter and the newsreader, because the newsreader was reading the news. We asked for a warrant. Afghan law is actually quite specific in terms of what the prosecution can do. And if they have to enter someone's premises, they have to get a court order. He ignored all of those things. He went straight to the district police. And the police chief came to our offices and instructed these people to be arrested. Then they were held and they were also beaten.
Now, you filmed this episode as it was happening and actually aired it. What's been the response?
Well, we got a lot of support. I mean, a lot of people came to our offices in support of the television station, people from civil society and the media, and it was, you know, overwhelming. Some people were supportive of us as a media organization. Some people were just upset with the Attorney General because they missed out on their favorite soap opera.
Let me ask you one final thing. At stake here is your media empire and also the future of Afghanistan and democracy. How optimistic are you at this moment that you'll survive this media law and a slide into authoritarianism that could be the next shoe to drop?
I think that any move to turn this place into a police state will be resisted by the public. I mean, they've had two bad experiences, one during the Taliban time and another, of course, during the communist time. We want to make a success of this country. This is the light at the end of the tunnel for Afghanistan. I mean, I think everything else is pretty much going wrong. But the media has allowed Afghans to feel connected to the rest of the world. They have been informed. They have been entertained. To a large extent, the media has allowed them to let off steam. This is where we confront corrupt individuals. This is where we inform the public of the government's mistakes. I think media is here to stay.
Saad, thanks so much.
Thanks, mate.
Saad Mohseini is the founder of Tolo TV. He spoke to us from Kabul.
Coming up, how to spin a massacre and why we keep dissing our neighbor to the north.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, four Marines faced a hearing for their roles in the alleged November 2005 massacre in the Iraq village of Haditha. After one of their own was killed by a roadside bomb, Marines allegedly murdered 24 Iraqi civilians, including women and children, in a fit of rage. The details are gruesome. On Thursday, Sergeant Sanik de la Cruz testified that he urinated on one of the civilian corpses. But the prosecution is about more than a murderous rampage. It is also about the conduct of the military afterwards, as an attempted whitewash finally gave way to an investigation. Paul von Zielbauer, a reporter for the New York Times, is at Camp Pendleton covering the hearings. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Let's go back to November 2005. Tell me, please, what happened immediately after the civilians were shot?
There were a number of reports that came from the platoon leader that said there were 15 what they call NKIAs, non-combatant, killed in action. In other words, four civilians, along with eight enemies. And then, of course, there was one Marine, Miguel Terrazas, who died in the roadside bombing of a convoy that started the whole incident.
Now, there was an official explanation for the civilian's death that appeared very shortly thereafter. Tell me what it was.
I believe it was the next day the Marines put out a news release for the reporters in Iraq and elsewhere that said that 15 Iraqi civilians had been killed as a result of the roadside bomb, I believe the exact language was. Of course, this would lead anyone who reads it to believe that a roadside bomb by insurgents blew up, killed a Marine, and also killed 15 Iraqis who happened to just be in that area. But as we know now, that's not at all what happened, and it's not even what the Marines thought happened at the time they put out this release.
But then, a few months later, up pops a reporter named Tim McGurk of Time magazine, who started asking questions about the incident. Because, for one thing, the cause of death, rifle shots and grenade explosions, did not square with the roadside bomb story. What was the Marines' response to McGurk's first inquiries?
senior commanders really viewed McGurk's questions as inflammatory, as sensational, as one Marine officer put it, and as biased and informed by the mayor of Haditha, who all the Marines considered a sympathizer to the Sunni insurgency. So they saw McGurk basically as a tool, a naive tool, of people who were trying to hurt the Marines and their mission in Anbar province.
Nonetheless, if I'm in charge and I get an inquiry from Time magazine about my Marines having been responsible for an atrocity, I don't accept, well, this guy's been spun. I go immediately to find out what happened on that day and how. Was an investigation immediately launched?
No, I mean, no investigation was launched. In fact, in the environment in which they were operating, and they make a great point of saying they were fighting for perhaps not the hearts and minds, but what they called the fence sitters in Iraq. That is the Iraqi civilians who were deciding whether to go with the insurgents or whether to cast their lot with the Americans. And the propaganda war was very heavy, and they felt like Mr. McGurk was simply feeding the enemy.
Of course, now it turns out that there is an eyewitness, a non-com, Sergeant Delacruz, who I mentioned earlier, who, under immunity, has testified to just that point-blank assassination. At what point did the military start to take this seriously?
The Marines began taking this seriously when Mr. McGurk brought a video that he had been given by people in Haditha of the aftermath, showing the dead women and children and so forth in these homes. And he showed it to the spokesman for the military in Baghdad. And that spokesman brought word of that video to his boss, Lieutenant General Peter Corelli. General Corelli then, on February 12th of 06, sent an email to General Richard Huck, who is the ultimate commander for these Marines. And he said, you know, Time magazine seems to be alleging certain things. What do you know of it? And as we heard in testimony, General Huck testified he didn't know about it at all. He hadn't been told, he said. But now that his boss was asking questions, that's when Marines began actually investigating.
Paul, I just want to share something with you. When I first read about Haditha, my heart sank in a way that I cannot remember it sinking before, because in that moment, I lost some special sense about what American troops fighting abroad, I had always been taught, just didn't do. And the way the military has handled this investigation, or not handled it, it makes me wonder if there were many other Hadithas out there lacking a Tim McGurk to discover them. Do we have any reason to think that this is happening in more places than this one isolated village?
I think in the insurgent and counterinsurgent warfare that you're seeing in Iraq now, I don't think any professor in any war college would be able to say you're able to win or even fight a war like this without those kinds of things unfortunately happening. There's no excusing the needless killing of people who are not armed. On the other hand, I've talked to a lot of Marines and soldiers, and I've been to Iraq myself, and the pressure that these guys are under every day, you know, is very intense. And the Marines have a slogan, you know, be kind and courteous and have a plan to kill everyone you meet. That's the central reality of a young Marine in Iraq.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Paul von Zielbauer is a reporter for the New York Times.
Oh, Canada, true north, strong and free. Oh, Canada, such disregard we have for thee. Or anyway, so it would appear if the deployment of correspondence by U.S. media is any measure. When the Washington Post vacates its Toronto bureau this summer, not a single American news organization will have a presence in Canada, our largest neighbor and trading partner. Journalism professor Edward Wasserman of Washington and Lee University thinks that's a shame and a lost opportunity to examine ourselves as reflected by a very similar and yet philosophically very different democracy.
I view the shutting down of a bureau as a kind of a symbol of a kind of withdrawal, of a self-blinkering, and of a denial of basic information that could enrich all of us and could really expand the range of public debate.
Now, you've said that the pulling out of correspondence from Canada says more about the wafer-thin imagination of our journalists than about the realities of contemporary Canada. What did you mean?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that the case of American attitudes toward Canada is a particular kind of cultural arrogance. It just seemed ironic that here's this country right on our border that is confronting precisely the kinds of issues of public policy that we are. Health care reform, aging population, immigration, environmental degradation, and is coming up with solutions of its own that are worth knowing about. And at the same time, we're most in need of novel approaches and most in need of a full range of alternatives. We are shutting ourselves off from what's going on there. But my concern is the way that our media, by defining what news is too narrowly, are assisting and enabling this kind of isolationism.
Well, we have covered some countries. As you note, the American media have had something of a love affair with Japan.
Well, Japan was an interesting case. We went through a flirtation, an infatuation with Japan in the 80s and 90s. We've since kind of separated, but at the time, Japan was sort of emerging as an economic rival and potentially a political rival to the United States abroad. It was extolled as a kind of a role model. The Japanese were hardworking, they were obedient and sang praises to their bosses every morning before work. They were the high savings rate, they didn't squander money on trivialities. They were all the things that your kind of lazy, soft American worker had ceased to be. It had the effect of being kind of a bracing morality tale that Japan was supposed to represent, and the media really fell for that.
I'm curious as to why the American media, if we want to refer to them as a monolith, which is always dangerous, would believe that Japan had something to teach us, but not Canada.
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the Japanese workers are treated badly and Canadian workers are treated well. The industrial leadership of America like solutions that have to do with sacrifice by workers, like solutions that have to do with increasing payoff to shareholders and to themselves. They don't like solutions in which workers get more benefits and a higher share of everything that's produced.
What you've all but said is that the American media are biased in favor of corporate interests.
I think the American media have a way of defining news and defining what realities to pay attention to in ways that dovetail very comfortably with the interests of corporate media. That's right. And not just corporate media, but in the interest of the system under which we function.
Do you think that any of this has to do with the need for a news peg? The Canadian public health system has been in place for a very long time. Wouldn't it be easier or more newsworthy for American newspapers if something were actually happening there?
Yeah, I agree. That's a big problem. By insisting on either a notable event or an important person to warrant exploring a longer term and larger social reality from abroad, by insisting on those kinds of criteria before we're going to deem it worthy of being considered news, we end up denying ourselves information that we kind of need to have.
Now that we've seen a political shift to something that is perhaps more multilateral, do you think that the coverage will follow? In other words, do you think we may end up putting our correspondents back in Canada?
Possibly. I think that the political shift in this country will have a bearing on the kind of information we bring from abroad. The environment is a terrific example of that. Suddenly we are listening to what other countries have done, how they've legislated, how they've managed to force polluting industries to clean up without damaging standards of living of ordinary people. All the same problems that we are facing now, other countries have been facing for a long time. You know, it occurs to me, our media don't cover California very well. And California, in its own way, is emerging as having a very distinct political culture. And yet, I don't think that's penetrated national consciousness, and I don't think people are looking seriously at whether there are things being tried out there that have broader application.
So would you feel better if we took all of those reporters that had been pulled out of Canada and stick them into California?
I think they'd feel better.
Okay, Ed, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Edward Wasserman is Knight Professor of Journalism Ethics at Virginia's Washington and Lee University. He wrote about Canada neglect in the Miami Herald.
It's Mother's Day weekend, so let's think about a very special mother. You've read about her. She's a successful manager with a good education, high-paying job, and all the right feminist credentials. But when her baby is born, she chooses to chuck it all, at least temporarily, to give little Taylor the motherly attention they both deserve. She has opted out and captured a lot of imaginations in so doing, either because she's a hero or because she's a traitor or because she's just too rich or lucky to be believed. But as author and journalist E.J. Graff noted in a recent issue of CJR, this archetype of post-feminism isn't to be believed, but rather the misleading product of lazy journalism.
They focus on a handful of highly educated, very well-off white women, under 4% of the American population. In just a couple of months or years out of their 30 or 40-year working lives, the couple of years when their children are infants and toddlers. And these women are usually culled from a sample of the author's friends from Princeton or Yale.
So you're suggesting that there's a journalism problem here, that the reporting is limited on anecdotal information based on the author's own social networks, eh?
That's important because these articles run in very influential media outlets, the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, and they set the tone for a lot of other newspaper outlets. If it runs the New York Times, some editor somewhere else says to a reporter, go write me that story, but in our suburb. And it sets the tone for public policy discussions. And if women are choosing happily to be home with their babies, that's a very private decision. But it's a public policy issue if most women and men need to work to support their families. And yet, schools and jobs and other American institutions are structured in ways that make that frustratingly difficult and sometimes impossible.
Well, then, if these stories are so manifestly misleading in terms of pure demographics, why do they so persist?
Carol Rivers, who's a media critic at Boston University, journalism professor, says that the Mommy Wars storylines are an intellectual version of thin thighs in 30 days. That if you scare women, if you suggest that if you either work or stay home, depending on the slant of the particular story, your marriage will fail and your kids will be miserable and you yourself will suffer, then they're going to buy your magazine or they're going to write letters to the editor or blog about it. And there's sort of no downside to that. It's a great marketing technique.
There's something else you've observed in writing on this subject, and that is that there's actually a danger of opting out because they can opt out, let's say, and then lo and behold find themselves part of the 50% of broken marriages and then can wind up in a real fix.
It is a real danger for women to leave the workforce. If you read these stories, these women are not saying, I am making a major philosophical choice about the value of motherhood and I'm going to stay home with my children forever. They're almost always saying, I'm going to stay home for a few years, and then I still have my skills in education and training, and I'm going to go right back into the workforce. That's really a myth that's being perpetuated by these stories. In fact, on average, they do not catch up to what they were earning before. If they want to work for a while at part-time work, which seems to me entirely reasonable, they are paid 21% less hourly than if they were doing the same job full-time, and they don't get career responsibilities. They're usually downgraded.
Are these stories going to go away?
I think they can go away when we really do have social change, and I don't mean after the revolution. When these opt-out stories call it opting out, what these women are really doing is taking maternity leave. They're staying home for a year or two with their infants, and that's considered a luxury in this country. Out of 168 countries, the United States is one of only five without mandatory paid maternity leave, right there with Lesotho, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. I think it's possible we will come into the 21st century. There's been a generational shift, and young parents, both women and men, are just not accepting that they have some personal philosophical decision to make in the way that people who grew up in the 60s or 70s or even 80s felt. I think that there's some attention to making some real social policy change on things like part-time tracks that do not completely take you off a career track or parental leave, family sick leave, early childhood education, some kind of child care standards, and health care that's not tied to a single all-consuming job. I think there is a possibility that this generation is going to say, this is ridiculous, we don't need to live this way, and let's have some new policies.
Yeah, I want to leave Swaziland in the dust.
Well, or at least catch up to Swaziland.
All right. E.J., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
E.J. Graff is senior researcher at Brandeis University's Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism.
Coming up, the cost of a stamp buys a world of pain, and the best PR money can't buy.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. I don't know if you want my 2 cents, but the U.S. Postal Service does. On Monday, the price of the first-class stamp will go up to 41 cents, the second rate increase in as many years. But before you go feeling sorry for yourself, consider the situation for magazine publishers. Apparently, many in that industry expected a rate hike of 11.7%. That's what the Postal Service first recommended to government regulators. But when some publishers looked at the fine print, they realized that their actual postage rates could go much higher, depending on how well they conform to new efficiency standards.
To take 2 examples, The Nation and The American Spectator learned that their rates would go up by 18%. And an analysis by McGraw-Hill found that 7,000 small and medium circulation magazines will see increases of more than 20%. As for large circulation magazines, well, the same analysis found their rate hikes won't go so high. Little surprise, say critics, considering that media giant Time Warner drafted the rate scheme that was mostly adopted. Media reform activist Robert McChesney is leading the charge against the rate hike. He says it strikes at the heart of the post office's historic role to foster America's marketplace of ideas.
In the 1790s, newspapers accounted for 70% of the weight of the post office traffic, but only 2% of its revenues. And the reason was they were heavily subsidized. It was the biggest subsidy in the government budget. The founders, Madison, Jefferson, Franklin, Washington, even Alexander Hamilton, the notorious penny pincher, all understood that unless you had a viable press system, you couldn't make the Constitution work. And they knew that the cost of mailing was such a big cost that if they made it very low, artificially low, they would encourage the spread of newspapers, literacy, ideas, and civic participation. It's a central policy. It's one that all Americans should be very proud of. This decision really turns it on its head. By giving the largest publishers the best rates and the smallest publishers the highest rates.
I mean, it sounds as if you're saying that, you know, the corporate boot has just come down on the post office, when really they're just applying what would seem to be logical formulas. You know, if you send out in bulk, you get a lower rate, right?
Absolutely right. And if this were a competitive industry, so that The Nation or National Review or anyone who wants to start a magazine could go find competing people to be their mailers, that would be fair enough. And other areas, the post office is competing with UPS and a lot of other companies, FedEx. In this area, they're what's called a market-dominant firm. They are the only game in town. So when the post office decides to give the best rates to the biggest firms, it's basically protecting their market power, making it much more difficult for new magazines to start or small magazines to survive.
Well, how small is small in this case?
Well, it's not that small. You look at magazines like the National Review or, say, The Nation with a circulation approaching 200,000. It's looking at an increase in expenses of $500,000 as a result of the increase they're going to face. This is really something they're not prepared to pay. They're not a wealthy publication, but 200,000 people is a lot of Americans who subscribe to this, and many more who read it maybe in libraries or lying around the house somewhere. So it's not just the smallest zines that are starting, although those certainly will get clobbered, but it's going up to fairly substantially sized publications.
But we keep hearing that print is pretty much on the way out anyway. You know, today distribution is practically free on the internet. I mean, if the point was to promote the marketplace of ideas, isn't it just as easy to do that on the net?
Well, you know, that's a really great question. And I think this is really sort of an ironic point that our oldest media policy, post office subsidies for periodicals, is now really a digital communication internet policy. Because if you go to the internet, a very high percentage of the material that people read on the internet that's journalism comes out of periodicals and newspapers, print publications. And what will happen is if we put these periodicals out of business, it means that there will be less material online to comment on to be spread around. National Review put it best. In their website, they said to their readers, they said, if you like National Review Online, we've got news for you. If our print publication goes out of business, our online operation goes out of business too. We depend on our print model to generate the resources to be online.
But that's not going to be forever, right? I mean, eventually they'll figure out how to monetize the web.
You know, eventually they will. We have to assume that, but that's not happening overnight. It certainly doesn't make any sense as a policy to have postal rates go up to such an extent that a lot of our most creative original media die off and there are not reporters getting paid money to do stories, and then think magically down the road that they'll find a way to make money in the web. The smart thing is to keep them alive, keep them healthy, and have a gentle, soft landing as we segue to the digital era.
All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Robert McChesney is the president of Free Press and host of Media Matters on WILL Radio in Urbana, Illinois. Ruth Goldway is a member of the U.S. Postal Regulatory Commission, which sets the rates charged by the Postal Service. She takes issue with McChesney's characterization of the rate scheme as a boon to big media paid for by the little guys.
I think it's unfair to say that that's what the new rate system has done. The new rate system gives benefits to those magazine publishers who will be more efficient in the way they process their mail. And some of the magazines that seem to be concerned about this, if they paid attention to the details, will actually get lower rates. Others may get higher rates, but if they try to make some adjustments to the way they present their magazines to the Postal Service, they might even get lower rates than they had before.
So just to be clear, you are categorically denying the conclusion of the researchers at McGraw-Hill who found that to a very great extent, this rate change will disproportionately hurt the smaller magazines.
I'm denying that charge. We're the regulatory watchdog, and we think we've come up with a system which is fair for everyone. And the rates that we have proposed in terms of the balance of small magazines versus high magazines is in fact better than what the Postal Service presented to us in early 2006 when they first made their case. The average rate increase was going to be 11.7%. It was never 11.7% for every magazine, only on average.
Wouldn't it serve the public interest better if it were simply a uniform 11.5 increase so that the playing field were more level for the smaller magazines?
Well, if that were the case, then no mailers would be encouraged to bundle their mail, put computer labeling on them, take them to a destination closer to where the readers are. We would have a system where the Postal Service had to pay far more money in terms of handling magazines, and the rest of the mailing community, the individual people who buy what will be a 41-cent stamp, would be hurt, and I might have then had to do a 42-cent stamp.
So if some of these small magazines actually do go out of business, as they claim they may have to, the larger public good is served because the rest of us don't have to pay an extra penny on that stamp?
We believe that there's a social purpose for the Postal Service that is for everyone. And part of that is magazines, but certainly not all of it. It includes personal correspondence and bills and people who don't have the internet who need to communicate with one another. And I suspect the real threat for magazines is the internet, not postage.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ruth Goldway is the commissioner of the United States Postal Regulatory Commission.
On Thursday, China once again accused the Dalai Lama of making trouble. After Chinese pressure forced him to cancel this weekend's planned trip to Brussels, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Zhang Yu said, quote, "We hope relevant countries will keep on high alert against remarks and deeds of the Dalai Lama clique aiming to undermine China's relations with them." But the deposed and exiled Tibetan head of state last month undermined international relations? Not. This month in Houston, Madison, and Chicago. Next month, he's slated for 6 stops in Australia, 2 in New Zealand, and 1 in India. To China, the Dalai Lama is a royal pain in the neck. But he remains serene in the face of harassment by the nation that brutalized his people and robbed him of his home. Listen.
Although we prefer direct communication with Chinese government, Chinese leaders, we haven't found proper opportunity.
Born in a poor farming village in 1935, he was 2 when he was identified as the 14th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, Tibet's spiritual leader and head of state. In 1959, he was on the run, living in India. Robert Thurman, now a professor at Columbia University, studied with him there and became the first American ordained as a Tibetan monk.
To me, he was like a really nice young guy, a little nervous and very sweet and friendly. He didn't bowl me over with his sort of superstardom.
He launched his perpetual tour in 1967. He's since met with many thousands of ordinary people, presidents, prime ministers, patriarchs, and popes. He's been on Time's list of the world's 100 most influential people. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's been savaged by Christopher Hitchens. It doesn't get better than that. What's his PR secret?
You know, people ask me often, like, who manages the Dalai Lama's PR and who's his PR firm and all this. And he's never had one. And in fact, sometimes they've been offered pro bono by different PR firms. And his people and himself have always declined because they don't want to be packaged without their own long-term understanding. They want to control their own image.
All he really wants is to get a simple message out about compassion and Tibet. But public relations isn't simple in such a complicated world.
He was on Larry King a bunch of times about 5-6 years ago, and he turned down some other programs. I won't mention names, not to embarrass them, but, you know, that have a 50 million audience instead of 1.2 million audience.
That program was Oprah's.
Tibetans, you know, they come from high altitude, you know, they climb mountains and things, and they herd yaks. And they're very self-reliant.
But, I mean, how self-reliant can you be in New York if you don't know the difference between Larry King and Oprah Winfrey?
I don't know. That's what we say sometimes.
Some of the Dalai Lama's public relations problems are far less innocuous. In 1998, he acknowledged that his administration in exile took money from the CIA in the 1960s, that the country he briefly ruled condoned what amounted to serfdom. He was accused of speaking out of both sides of his mouth on the issue of homosexuality, and he's friends with Richard Gere.
But somehow there seems to be this bounce-back quality to the Dalai Lama, a sort of Teflon thing, that these things just seem to add to his glow somehow.
Robert Barnett is a lecturer in Tibetan studies at Columbia University.
And he doesn't seem to get pulled down by even the slightly more difficult figures like the Steven Seagal, that film star who got declared by one Tibetan Lama to be himself the reincarnation of a 17th century Tibetan Buddhist teacher.
You and I were the same.
There's a difference, my man. You have faith.
I don't.
For real?
For real, yeah. And this really seemed to be the limit of credibility. I mean, a huge number of Buddhists were shocked and horrified by that. And the Dalai Lama carefully distanced himself from that. He seems to have survived it.
There's an old and durable aphorism about media that they love to build those heroes up and then take them down. How come he hasn't been taken down?
I don't know. I have to admit that I'm one of the people who said, you know, 20 years ago, it wouldn't last, you know, and I'm wrong. So I shouldn't be making guesses here.
Maybe it's that particular element in Tibetan Buddhism that seems to bestow enlightenment at random, even on Steven Seagal?
So there is a great appeal to that you don't know where these great lamas are going to appear.
Donald Lopez is a professor of Buddhist and Tibetan studies at the University of Michigan.
It could be in Tibet. It could be in California. Anybody's child, at least hypothetically, could be the incarnation of a great lama.
I'm nothing special. I'm just like you.
But maybe we just love the way he combines modernity and tradition, the spiritual with the commercial, literally. Robert Barnett.
He did a series of advertisements once, wasn't it, for Apple computers, which was big as well. You see, where he places himself in front of the modern and in front of the fashionable, all the things that he would appear not to be.
Or maybe we love that movie stars follow in his wake.
Buddhism always caught on first in the royal court.
After all, says Donald Lopez, celebrities are our royalty.
The aristocracy, the nobility, who find Buddhism somehow interesting. And so when people complain, as they often do, that Buddhism seems to be kind of a celebrity religion and all of the Richard Gere and Sharon Stone and so forth are devotees of the Dalai Lama and somehow take offense at that, I think they're missing a larger historical perspective.
And then there are the movies about him or his native land, Bernardo Bertolucci's Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves, 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, and especially Martin Scorsese's Kundun with actual relatives of the Dalai Lama.
Holiness, the Chinese have moved their camp. The Oracle's route is safe for us now. We must go.
Yes.
Sanctuary has been arranged in India. They're expecting you.
Kundun helped give Tibet an identity distinct from so many other oppressed minorities. Before the current crop of films, there was only 1937's Lost Horizon by Frank Capra, whose Tibet was Shangri-La, pretty much an Oriental Brigadoon.
Tibet always was the empty space on the map.
Robert Barnett.
Not just in Western accounts, even in the first millennium in Arabic accounts, Tibet was being described in this way as the empty space. It really was the space on which people could project fantasies. I think that he's taken that Tibet that's played that role in history and turned it into a sort of personal Tibet. He's now a walking empty space that travels around in which we can place some of those fantasies and actually go and listen to him. And he's humorous and immediate and very tangible. And it seems to be a sort of Tibet that's come alive, even though Tibet, the country, has disappeared.
Barnett believes it's empty space that forms the basis of the Dalai Lama's appeal, the reason why his constituency can range and change from Indian conservatives to American hippies.
What I mean is that the Dalai Lama, in his general talks, is presenting a kind of philosophy and a kind of approach to life that is really not marked by anything in particular. It's almost featureless. It's just an idea of compassion, treating people well.
Compassion is important because more compassionate mental attitude there, you can see everything more better, more clearly.
It's classically what media people talk about when they try to find neutral terminology, something that could be open to almost anyone who listens to it. My guess is that that's what's made this happen. And I should add one thing. He has received enormous help constantly from the Chinese authorities.
That's the capper. That's what makes Dalai Lama mania so enduring. Aside from his profoundly appealing message of peace and love, of course, you couldn't buy a better foe than the People's Republic of China.
They just constantly repeat the kind of propaganda dream of attacking him again and again. It's a bit like a Rottweiler savaging a puppy. They make him look more and more docile every time they bare their teeth.
I have nothing to offer, just to listen, to learn myself.
The Dalai Lama is 72. To win the PR war, the Chinese only have to wait him out. Oh, but we're talking about someone who's forever reborn. That could be a very long wait.
So, that's all. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Mark Phillips, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and Paul Schneider, and more help from Christopher Wirth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter at that address. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.